Welcome and bienvenue to Emily Is Not in Paris, the podcast, where we investigate why and how people move to France. This podcast hopes to demystify the allure of navigating French society as a foreigner. Through conversations with people who have spent a considerable amount of time in France, whether 3 months, 3 years, or a lifetime, we plan to understand how France changed their scope on life and the work that they do. My name is Fatima Kenadiabi, and I am a native New Yorker who moved to Paris about 5 years ago on a whim. As each year passes by, I wonder what motivates people to dig roots in France, and so I decided to start this podcast. Subscribe to this podcast where all podcasts can be found. Merci, and thank you. Welcome back to another episode of Emily Is Not in Paris, the podcast. So this week we have with us the Australian comedian, Jonnell Duffy. How are you doing today?
I am fine on this fabulous Tuesday. The burgeoning transformation of winter to spring. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so glad to be speaking to you today. I saw you, perhaps it's been almost a year ago, on TikTok.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that's when I first started doing it, yeah.
And on TikTok, you stood out because you do great impersonations of your French fiancé.
Oh, thank you. He probably wouldn't agree, but to be honest with you, if I'm going to give you an insider secret, they're not impersonations of him. They're just generic impersonations of French people.
I'm curious. So on your TikTok, you talk a lot about how before France, you were in Iceland.
I was. Oh, you mean like in my bio? It says I used to almost be someone in Iceland. Yeah. It's true. I was there for 5 years before I came to France. And that's a story in itself. Like, how the hell does somebody end up from there, from the other side of the world?
I mean, when I think about Iceland and Australia, I think two exact opposites. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Polar even. It's very far away from each other. And it's a question everyone asks me all the time, is that why? And the very quick version is I was in a long-term relationship for almost 10 years. I got dumped. I was about to turn 30. And at the time I had an Australian passport and a British passport, which was technically part of Europe at the time. This was before Brexit, and I decided I wasn't tied to anything, and I just wanted to go on an adventure because I spent my whole 20s being in a relationship, devoting my life to somebody else's career, all that kind of crap. And so I decided to do some travel, and I had a friend. I'd been to Iceland once before as a tourist. I had a friend who lived there, and she told me, why don't you come and stay in my spare room at the end of your travel and decide what you want to do? And I was like, that sounds great. And I thought I would be there for maybe a month. And then 5 years later, I was still there.
Nice, nice. And from what I understand, you're famous in Iceland.
I was, yeah. to a degree, you could say that. Like, people knew who I was. I was the only openly gay comedian in the entire country. And I also was probably one of the top English speaking comedians in Iceland. And that all was coincidence. I was a comedian before I went there. I didn't realize there was stand-up comedy in English. It just sort of happened. Part of the reason why I stayed so long was I just kept getting work. So, I wasn't like Bjork famous, but she knows who I am. That's really? Because I made fun of her when she was in the audience once. I think we're on good terms now, but I don't think she was a fan of me for a while.
And so how do you process having such a thriving career in stand-up in Iceland and then coming to France, where essentially you're kind of hitting the pavement yet again?
How do I process it? I cry in the shower a lot.
Do you really?
Oh, no, not in the shower. I just do it in bed. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. Like to give like sort of a preface to anyone listening to this. And I have listened to some previous episodes of your podcast. I think my journey to this country is probably a little bit different from what most people have heard, in that I never chose to live here. It wasn't a conscious it was sort of like the best option out of a bunch of horrible options. You are right in saying, like, I guess what you're trying to say is, was it hard? Yeah, it was really hard. And it still is. It's still hard every day because I made a TikTok about this in a joking way. In the TikTok, I think I say something like, were you famous in Iceland? Well, sort of. And what's it like living in France now? Well, have you ever been a god? And then you're not anymore. And when I say that, I don't mean like a literal god. I don't mean god complex. I'm still a human. When I like being famous in Iceland, by the way, is very different to being famous in the rest of the world. Because in Iceland, all you need to do to get some level of fame is scream loud enough, because there's 300,000 people in the country and everyone knows who everyone is anyway. So celebrities aren't really a thing. I guess it's more notoriety is a thing that happens in Iceland. People get to know, oh, that person is responsible for this. But probably the biggest change I noticed from the thriving career that I had in Iceland to moving to France was that I really went from being someone who was very much in control of my life. I could do things when I wanted to do them, make things happen when I wanted to make them happen. It was in theory, it was basically the dream that I set out to achieve when I first started doing stand-up comedy. And here in France, it's the opposite. I'm very much at the mercy of other people, other companies, other ideas. And it's gone from I jump when I feel like it to I jump when someone sneezes because I thought they said to jump.
It's interesting. It's very interesting. Two questions. Do you know who Gad Elmaleh is?
Oh, yeah. You mean the guy who stole all his jokes from Jerry Seinfeld?
Yeah, him. Yeah.
And still has a career? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is very true. I mentioned him because he has a show on Netflix. I don't remember. Anymore.
Big in France.
Yeah, big in France. And it's like, you know, and I saw his like stand-up special, a different stand-up special that he did that was also on Netflix about how he is essentially, you know, this big star in France, or at the time was a big star in France. And now he tried to make
it. Everybody knows who he is. Yeah, yeah.
But he tried to make it in the US, which is like a different type of arena, a different type of like game and whatnot. And it's really interesting to see like how some people try to make their work go global or make it work in a new market, and how sometimes it works, sometimes it fails, right? And so
yeah. And I guess I mean, there is I could in no way compare myself to Gad.
Not yet. I mean, you don't steal jokes. I mean, there's that. So
well, no, I don't. But I guess what I mean is like, I wasn't performing in another language before either. So the comedy I was doing was always in English. It's not like I was suddenly moving over here and trying to do comedy in French. I'm still basically targeting the same market. It's just in a different country.
But do you find that the French market is, I don't know, perhaps more open to having international comedians come in, or do you find it's a bit less open? I gather that Iceland is a very bilingual nation, right? They speak Icelandic and then they speak English.
100%. Like it is for anyone who's never been there before. They do have their own language. I know a lot of people don't know this. Iceland has its own language, Icelandic. It's a very old language. It's also a very complex language. If you're trying to learn French and you think it's hard, go spend a couple of weeks learning Icelandic, and then French will just look like a walk in the park. But everyone, almost everyone there speaks English because they have to. Because if they want access to media, if they want to be able to watch things on Netflix, there's no subtitles in Icelandic for anything. There's no, it's not like in French, you could just get the dubbed version. Oh, I don't speak English. I don't like to listen to things in the English language. I watch the doublage. But it's not possible in Iceland. So most people have a really like sea level fluent degree of English by the time they're in high school. So as a foreigner living there, you actually, I would probably say you don't need to speak Icelandic to survive there, but you have to at least speak English, because that's often the only common language for people. So, it is very different. Your question, sorry, this is such a long roundabout way of answering it. But you were saying if it's more open or less open, I would say from what I've seen, and I'm completely aware of the fact that I'm very new to this country and there are people who've been doing comedy here in English a lot longer than I have. So I don't want to offend anybody, but I would say that there are a lot of similarities in that the English comedians get treated differently to the locals. And we certainly don't have the same level of opportunity or the same amount of audience we can pick from.
Very, very valid.
Yeah.
And how would you describe the English speaking comedy scene here in Paris? I mean, I've been to a few shows.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, my first Friday night in Paris, I was in a comedy. I went to like 2-3 different comedy shows. I had no idea where I was going, but all I knew was that I wanted to get into the French or at least Anglophone comedy scene.
Which, can I ask, do you remember what was the first night you went to? Was it at Au Chat Noir?
I don't really remember, but it was called New York Comedy in Paris, hosted by Sebastian Marx.
Sebastian Marx. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a very professional show. I've done that one a bunch of times. It's now at Barbès Comedy Club on Sunday evenings. I would say, like, from what I've seen so far, the English speaking comedy scene in Paris, I would say, is very open, very, people are nice, which is, I don't know, it's different from Australia.
wait, what? Different from Australia? You know, we have this impression that Australians are super nice and super chill and super like, well, I hate to say laid back, but yeah.
They're not. They're so not. It's the biggest lie that's ever been told to anybody. And the way you can see this straight away, like let's just crush that straight away. Australians are laid back to a point, but we love rules. Like if you and I were in a bar right now, you, me, and a French person, right? And there was a room that had better seats, but there was a velvet rope in front of the room, right? Velvet rope is the international signal for you can't go into here. I can guarantee you the French person will be the first person to say, but that rule is, if they don't want us in, they will tell us, you know, like they'll just go, let's just go sit in there. And I think Americans would probably be like, we could see. Australians would be like, no, that is a rule. We don't break rules. That's why we have a safe country. We're not as laid back as people think. We're on time. We have ridiculous working weeks. We're uptight. We're not as laid back as people think we are, but the comedy, I mean, and honestly, I can burn all my bridges because I don't have plans to move back to Australia. I don't give a shit. but in my experience, I used to live in Melbourne, which is like the comedy capital of Australia. It is exactly what you would imagine of like the comedy rooms in America. It's run by straight white guys. If you're a woman or a minority, I mean, I've heard myself, we already have a gay that night. Can you come back next week? Because we can't have two in one show. That's too much of the same thing. Never mind the eight straight white guys who just get up and tell the same jokes about hating their wife and their kids. But, you know, it's very much a boys club. Comedy in general is a boys club. Let's not pussyfoot around. It is a boys club. It is run by straight white guys. You have to pander to whatever ego or concerns that they have, or go start your own scene or find your own audience, which is kind of how I did it. But I would say in my experience, both in Iceland and in France, in Europe at least, it has been less of, it's still a boys club. But I have noticed in Paris, at least in the English speaking scene, it's more open. People are more, they just care. Like, do you get laughs? Do you want to perform here? If you're good at what you do, please come and perform at our room. I do have to preface that with, I was lucky enough to enter the Parisian English speaking comedy scene at a different level than most people, because I was already working professionally before I moved here. I had all the videos and things that I could just send. So, you know, I've got crap loads of material behind me. If I wanted to book a night, I could go, oh yeah, here's three videos. Because often that's what you need. You need to prove that you can do something, and someone goes, great, come and do 5 minutes. So instead of me having to convince somebody that I'm good enough to do 5 minutes, I was able to enter at New York Comedy Night level, which was very lucky, because as soon as that happened, now I'm at the point where people just ask me. They just send me messages. Can you come and do the 14th? Can you do whatever? So I would say the Parisian scene is a lot more open and friendly. But I mean, there's assholes everywhere, but not as much in this city. Everyone's pretty nice.
That's interesting. It's very, very interesting. And out of curiosity, have you seen the TV show Drôle?
Not yet, but I can tell you that every single person who lives in this country who does comedy gets asked that question about 17 times a day right now. And the funny thing, to be honest with you, I saw the trailer for it last week. Because in my household, I'm not fluent in French, and I'm trying to get better. And in my household, we have currently one day a week where we only communicate in French. And that also means that we can only watch French TV. And which was one of the hardest things for me, because French TV is often about depressed people living in the suburbs who smoke a lot and don't have any money, which is such a hoot. Especially when you come home after the job that you do that you hate. It's so wonderful to watch those TV shows on a Wednesday. And so I saw the trailer for Drôle, which, you know, to anyone who doesn't speak French, it means funny. And it looks like a great show, but for me, I will watch it, but it's a show about people trying to make it in comedy and all the things that come along with trying to make it in comedy and how their relationships are affected by them trying to make it in comedy. For me, it's a bit like if you were a hairdresser and then you came home and you watched a drama about people who cut hair. Like, it's, I live it, so I don't need to see it.
No, I totally get it. But on the show, they do have, from time to time, they do have real stand-up comedians.
Yeah.
They come on the show and do, like, you know, a quick, like, maybe 2-3 5-minute set.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was thinking, I was like, this would be so cool if they actually had an Anglophone comedian do a set on the show. Because I think people don't necessarily think about English-speaking comedy in Paris or in Germany or in Iceland or wherever you go. And personally, like, when I travel, I love to go to comedy shows in foreign countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and it's great. And I love seeing the locals of that country, the natives of that country, do stand up in English, as well as the expats, the foreigners, etc., who are coming in. I think it's such a fascinating way to learn more about a city. or an environment.
I agree with you. I think it would be great if they did that in that show, but I can tell you 100% exactly how it would work. If they did, if it comes back for a second season, and then maybe one of the character arcs is they want to start doing comedy in English as well. They will either just find a French comedian who already performs in English, or they'll get Paul, like, and Paul Taylor, who everyone knows, who's amazing. But I've seen this happen in other countries before with comedies. What we always need to realize is the people who write these shows and then the casting agents, who are the laziest people in the fucking planet. I'm sorry. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear. But they really are. I had an argument with a screenwriter about how lazy casting agents are, which later the next day turned into me getting a role in a TV show for him to prove a point. But true story. But the casting agents won't, they're like, oh, we'll just find a comedian. Let's Google English comedian France. And they'll just find the top result. And then, you know, you'll see Paul Taylor in the show. Is that an accurate representation of people at the open mic level of comedy? No, because he's selling out stadiums, but they're going to get a quality result from that. So I don't think those roles, I'm not going to get cast in that TV show for sure. But there are other people who've been grinding the pavement long before I have here. But I mean, I did also find that in Iceland as well. There is something when you live in another country, even if they are trying to take a snapshot of the Anglophone scene, they will, in my experience, they will always think of themselves first. So if they want an English-speaking comedian in an Icelandic TV show, they will see if an Icelander can do it first before they find someone who actually speaks English. It was the story of my career there.
I also think it's like the story of the job search in France, you know.
For sure. For sure. Can a French person do it? No. Can an English person do it? Yes, but they're not fluent in French. Oh, do we want to have to speak another language in the office? They never said they want you to speak another language in the office. Yeah, but we're uncomfortable with it. So no, they can go burn in the pits of hell forever. And that's being foreign in France.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's complicated. Yep. It's definitely complicated. Before, you said that you kind of noticed in your life, you've kind of like forged your own path and whatnot. Do you have any special plans here in Paris? Like, are you going to start your own comedy night? I mean, I guess.
Oh, never. Never.
Too much work, too much paparazzi. Yeah.
So much work. Also, I don't have an interest in, and this sounds like, when it comes to me, and stand-up comedy, comedy is what I do. What most people don't realize before they get into stand-up comedy is that 90% of your time, even when you are getting paid to do it, 90% of your time is just getting people to let you do it. So 90% of your time is plugging your show, booking a theater, or when you're first starting out, getting someone to let you have 5 minutes in front of an audience. 90% of your job is doing that. I admire people who start a comedy night. And actually, at the moment, I think there's a website, it's English Comedy in Paris. There is currently every single night of the week, you can go see stand-up comedy in Paris in English. And there's a bunch of people running all of these rooms. I have no desire to ever do it because I just don't care. I don't care enough about other people's comedy. And I think for me, you just have to be selfish. So I say yes to other people's rooms, but I'm not going to start one at all.
Valid statement. And also, I think, you know, it's important to understand that it's time consuming. It's, mm-hmm. It requires a certain sense of business acumen and, seeing things. I don't know. It's complicated. It's complicated. And I really yep. do understand what you mean by saying, no, it's not for me. It's not in the cards for me. And that you got to be a bit selfish because when you are a comedian, you are your own manager, your own agent, your own marketing coordinator, your own cheerleader. It's really... Yeah. Honestly, I don't know how comedians do it. It's really like a challenging job to constantly get rejection.
And it is, it's nothing but actors talk about how the job is rejection. Actors have no idea what, and I say I was an actor before I was a comedian. Like I was, that's what I trained in before I moved on to comedy. I know acting rejection. I know comedy rejection. Nothing. There's no comparison. Comedy rejection is much worse. But also like going back to what you said, another reason, this is just a personal one, why I cannot start a comedy room. I have a personal stigma against it because when I first started out, when I was like in my early 20s, there were so many dudes that were horrible at comedy and no one would let them perform because they were so bad. So they just started a room. And so I've come to associate sometimes people starting a comedy room with people starting a room so that they can get 5 minutes. And I don't need that. So no, I'm not going to do it.
Fully get it. And do you think you'll try to do something else to stand out in the Parisian scene or?
I mean, I like to try and be realistic about my expectations. And be thankful that I've been able to get what I have so far in such a short space of time. Currently, if I were to talk, if we're talking business, if you're saying like, what's your 5-year plan? There's no real plan. It's just what I've always done, which is just keep building an audience to the point where I can just say I'm doing something and people will come. And that's sort of been my approach for my entire career. Just instead of thinking that performing in a basement on a Monday night for 3 people will one day get you discovered, I got sick of that. Because in Australia, for anyone who's interested, basically the road to professional comedy in Australia is you perform at open mics and then you try and do the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. And everyone is fighting to get represented by the one agency that will get you on TV. And when you get one chance to invite that agency to your show. They're called Token Entertainment. I don't care. Burning all the bridges today. If you invite somebody from Token to your show, they'll come. But if they don't like it, they'll never come again. So like people are just waiting until they're perfect and they're just constantly trying to wait to get discovered. I didn't like that attitude. So I was like, well, can I just try and build an audience around people who want to come and see me do what I like to do? And then that's what I kind of took with me to Iceland. And that's what I'm trying to do in France. It is harder because my only sort of way of connecting to an audience here has been through TikTok. And I have been, for lack of a better word, nicheified on TikTok. If you go on my TikTok, you can just see exactly what videos are the ones that go viral. Oh, it's only the ones where I make fun of French people.
Same.
Yeah. You make fun of French people, 100,000 views. You just do a regular observation. Or maybe you get suspended because you made a joke about straight people and God knows you're not allowed to talk about them anymore.
You got suspended on TikTok?
No, but I've been shadow banned for certain things. I got a yellow warning on Facebook for commenting on somebody's story, straight people are gross. That was hate speech. Yeah. So I'm now like on the Facebook no fly list. Never mind all the times people sent me actual death threats, just for being gay. But it happens. Yeah. But that's the, I guess my plan, sorry to get back to the point. My plan is to just sort of keep trying to build an audience and see like what I'm doing right now. I have my show on the 7th. Of May. It's kind of like an experiment. What I'm trying to see is, can I fill a room? Can I fill a room in Paris? Am I ready yet? do enough people know about me, or do I need to go back to just doing the different things and plugging stuff on social media? And then will all these people following me on TikTok actually translate to ticket sales? Because otherwise, what's the point?
And I think what you're doing right now is really nice, because I saw your TikTok. Well, I recently saw a TikTok scroll through my feed, and it was about the show on the 7th. I was like, oh, he has a show. So I'm going to, you know, I was like, oh, wait, I should, you know, book tickets to see this. You know what I mean? No, yeah. I think, listen, I'm a strong believer in using your TikTok as a means of marketing your other business initiatives, whether it's, you know, you have an Etsy shop and you're doing, you know, artisanal products, or you're a stand-up comedian, et cetera. No, I think it's fascinating. And what you said about, you know, TikTok, you know, having a niche, it's, I'm in the same boat. Like, I'm trying to be an American in Paris. However, I want to do aesthetic vlogs where I just, you know, do snapshots of like me by the Louvre or on the Champs-Élysées eating croissant. Yeah. But that doesn't work for me. That works for the other girlies, but not for me. It's only when I talk about like weird French observations or try to imitate a French accent that, and I have fun doing that. I totally have fun doing that. But it's just so funny that I feel as though that's what works. Whereas,
and you can sort of feel like it limits you in a way, because even when you, it becomes, for anyone who's not a TikToker, because I guess that you can define both of us as that, as reluctantly as we want to be referred to as TikTokers, we can't deny that we have a following. It's I think the numbers are like what they would classify mid-tier influencer. I found out
mid-tier influencer.
I'm a mid-tier. You are too. I think so. Yeah. Once you get over a certain amount, you're no longer micro. You're mid-tier. And mid-tier is huge. It's like the millennial age. the millennial generation, it goes for like 30 years. You do, even though you know, like you've got a following and people like what they like when you're doing that kind of stuff, sometimes you don't feel like it. Sometimes you want to make a humorous observation about something else. Sometimes you just want to take a picture. Sometimes you don't want to make a TikTok, but if you have other things, like, you know, you've got this podcast, you've got other things going on, I have my comedy, it's a means to promote what you're trying to do. It can become draining. Like, there are days where I just, I mean, if we're gonna spill some tea, like there are days where I make a video and I know immediately the first 50 comments that will come, I know which point in the video the French people will fixate on that is not the joke, because they often do that. They'll fixate on how I said one particular word wrong rather than seeing the actual point of the video. Then it will start an argument in the comments section between people. I will do nothing and the video will get a million views. Like, it's just... And then for me, it's like, it's boring. Like, I would have had more fun making fun of some of the other stuff that I do in my comedy, because my comedy is more than just being a foreigner in France.
Valid point. And I think what's really interesting is that you actually put clips from your former stand-up onto TikTok. And I think that's a really nice way for people to see what you can do that's outside of this niche of, I'm a foreigner living in Paris or living in France.
Yeah. And if you go look at those, you'll see that nobody watches them.
I do.
Thank you. But I will say one thing. I will sort of like think one thing that has pleasantly surprised me about people in Paris is that they book tickets. People actually book for the. I know this might be a surprise. Icelanders never plan ahead. They don't book ahead for anything. When I left there, I was at the point where if I book one night in a 200-seat theater, it's going to sell out, right? But on the day of the show, there will be 3 tickets sold. And all of those, or the rest of the 197 people, will buy on the day at the door. They just don't buy ahead. They don't buy tickets ahead for anything ever. Like one of the most famous comedians in Iceland, Ari Eljan, who's got like a Netflix special. He's a really good friend of mine. Even he complains sometimes, like, will they just buy tickets? They just don't. And like for me, like the theater I'm performing in on the 7th of May, it only seats 70 people, so it's not hard to fill. I think the tickets went on sale a week ago. There's only 19 left. So like it's going to sell out. But I've never had that experience where it's like, oh, I don't have to stress. We're already breaking even. But that's one thing I think is good. Like French, the people who live in France at least do plan ahead.
And I also think it's because the venues here in Paris are pretty small. Mm. So people are used to not, getting a ticket to the show that they're looking for, or even going to the museum. Like I have been rejected from the Louvre before.
Oh my god.
Oh no, when they get full, they get full and they don't let you in. And this was before the pandemic, where the capacity, the gauche was much freer, I think. Mm.
And they're like, too bad, so sad.
Too bad, so sad. Yeah. And I felt really bad because I had a friend come in from out of town and I was supposed to meet up with them at the Louvre, and they were getting there earlier than I was because I think I had work or something or school. Mm-mm. And I arrived and I couldn't get in. And so they were just like wandering the Louvre by themselves. And I felt so bad. Yeah.
I've never been.
No.
I
have to go.
Just the thought of going to some of those places terrifies me because I'm just, I don't know. There's just my first experience in Paris. I basically got mugged in Montmartre by the bracelet guys. I would say this was not a scam. This was a clear, I was threatened with violence unless I gave them money. That's a mugging.
Daylight?
Yeah, it was sunset. Yeah. And we were less than 30 meters away from an armed guard. And it was 10 guys.
10 people.
It was my first experience in Paris. I'd never visited the city. My partner, he's from Normandy. And we would always come to Paris and then go to Normandy. So the first time we came to see his family, we came to Paris. We were like, let's do a day here because I had never seen the city. And he was like, let me take you to Montmartre where Amelie was filmed. And we went up there. We decided it was nice. It was sunset. Let's walk down the stairs and instead of taking the escalator thing. As we got to the bottom of the stairs, one guy walked in between me and him, and then another just grabbed my hand and put a bracelet on it. And I tried to pull my hand away and he would not let it go. He just simply, that's assault. Like he refused to release my hand from the moment he grabbed it until the moment I left. He did not let go of my hand. Within seconds, I was surrounded by 9 other guys. And then that's when I noticed that I've got like a thing about like in situations like this, I just assess everything around me. And I saw that there was an armed guard at like the escalator thing. He had a gun. Mm-hmm. He clearly did not care what was happening in this situation. These people didn't care that this guy was an armed guard. They had another 3 guys who were standing in between me and my partner, because they knew that I spoke English and he spoke French. Then they did the whole thing about here's a bracelet. It's good luck for you. And I was like, I know what's going on here. Like, I don't want the bracelet. I don't want it. And then another guy, because I started raising my voice, another guy came in. He was like, you have to be nice to my boss. You have to respect him or bad things will happen to you. Like it got really... and then I was like, so what do you need? Why won't you let me go? And they were like, well, we gave you a bracelet. You need to give us money. And I was like, well, I didn't want the bracelet and I don't have money. I put my hand in my pocket. And then they said, your wallet's in the other pocket. So they just like, it's like we had been tailed. Yeah. They knew where my wallet was. And basically, I just had to give him money. And then they let us go. And that was my welcome to Paris. That was, but for me, it's not just there. Like, one thing that growing up in Australia and growing up and spending a lot of time in Iceland, they're both very safe countries. And even like I've spent quite a lot of time in places like London. I feel often that the level of normalized crime in Paris is absurdly high. Like, a lot of people would consider that particular act, that entire story, a lot of French people would call them pickpockets.
Yeah.
They would say that was a pickpocket. No, a pickpocket is someone who steals from you. You don't know they stole from you. That was a mugging. That was a threat on my life. I was basically being told that I needed to give the money or bad things will happen to me. It had nothing to do with the bracelet. And I guess when I look back on it now, it was just the end of the day. The tourists had gone. They were desperate. They probably have quotas, you know. But it just... That was my first experience in Paris.
Sorry that happened to you.
It's okay. But like a result of that is that like I now get very, just the thought of going places like the Louvre or like anytime someone has ever said, oh, let's meet at Champ de Mars. I just think like, are you insane? Like, are you crazy? Are you asking for everything you own to be stolen? You know, because that's where these things happen. They don't happen in the regular, in the banlieue. They don't happen in the regular arrondissement. They happen near the Eiffel Tower. They happen at Montmartre. They happen in the tourist places. Also, like now that we're living in a post-COVID world, there's less tourists. So there have been many stories about how the people who used to target tourists are now starting to target people who live here. So I think that's something that a lot of people don't prepare you for is the amount of not just crime, but the fact that it's so normalized. Like the amount of times I've told people that story, French people, and they're like, oh, well, that happens. And, oh, okay, cool. Great. Fuck my drag.
No, I totally get it. And it's a bit frightening, not a bit frightening. It's rather frightening. And I'm from New York. And yep. In New York, I have always felt safe. I've never felt in danger, to be honest. Mm. However, a lot of people, when they think of New York City, they think of high crime. They think of these types of things. And, you know, I've heard stories, but not that many. Maybe because most of the people I hear stories from they're also locals like myself.
Yep.
And so when I came to Paris and I saw this, like this culture of pickpocketing or mugging, like I actually have a friend from Brooklyn, mind you. Another friend from Brooklyn, his last weekend here in Paris, he was here for like a year, last weekend, got mugged.
Mm-hmm.
They said knife, knife, knife. Now, you know, it's 3, 4 a.m. in the morning. You can't really see what's happening. You're by yourself. You don't want to question it. Lost his phone and wallet, I believe.
And I've been to New York and I felt safer in New York than I do in many parts of Paris. Like it's a different kind. I don't know. It's just.
But there is violence in New York. There is violence in New York.
Oh, for sure.
But pickpocketing culture in France is incredibly strong. And when it deviates off to like straight up mugging, I mean, it's just.
And sometimes there are elements of like, you know, everyone talks about like, oh, the scams to look out for, you know, the thing of like, excuse me, do you have a lighter? Like, you know, that's a scam to get you to come closer so that they can threaten you. You don't know this one? Oh, it happens to people at like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning. They say, do you have a lighter? And you lean in and say, no, I don't. And then they go, well, here's a knife. Give me everything you have. So stuff that you learn from people or the, you know, excuse me, sir, did you drop this ring? That's a scam, a well-known scam that happens near the Eiffel Tower. There's the bracelets at Montmartre. There's pickpockets on all of the forms of public transport. I mean, I have a joke I haven't said at all on stage just about like the, on the metro, they say, you know, in French, they say pickpockets operate at this station. Does that work? Are there ever pickpockets who sit on the train and go, oh no, they found us?
I think it does. And I'll give you an example of when I think it worked for me. Mm. So I speak French, and I've been learning ever since I arrived here. I mean, I learned a bit before, and my mom speaks French. She speaks it perfectly well. And one time we were on the train, we were on line 6, which for me is like, and you're asking to get pickpocketed if you're on line 6 after a certain stop. That's the one that goes to the Eiffel Tower, Trocadero.
Oh, yeah. I don't associate that one as a dangerous line in my head, but I should. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, once you get closer to the 16th arrondissement, then that's a...
It's bougie.
Yeah, exactly. And there were these pickpocketers on the train, and I could tell because, you know, they look at you in a certain way. Really, they look at your pockets in a certain way. And me and my mom, when we always speak in English. That's how I was raised. And that's how she, So what's interesting is that I think they announced it on the train that there were pickpocketers. And then the people on the train told us, I was like, damn, we look like tourists to the point where they're telling us. I'm like, no, I was like, merci, merci bien. And sometimes the pickpockets, they will talk out loud about their next victim. And sometimes they don't realize that their victims might understand English. Like I have a friend who's like eight. Well, not like he is Asian. And he hangs out with a lot of French Asian people.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they mistake him and his friends for like Asian tourists who don't speak a lick of French. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you know, sometimes he gets into situations, but no. It's pickpocketing in France. It's just like, it's interesting.
And I also like, so, you know, my partner's French. We can speak French together if we have to. We learned, I think it was Pride last year, that when we're in public and it's late at night, don't speak English to each other. Because then you become a target. We were out late enough that we had to get the night bus home, which, you know, 2 a.m, woo, Pride during COVID. And he, you know, we'd been drinking, we were tipsy, and he was just saying something to me in English. Within 5 seconds of him starting to speak in English to me, we were asked like 4 times if we had a lighter by people, and then they just sort of hung around. And then you just remove yourself. And that's when we discovered, like, in moments like that, you can't speak English to me because people will just know they'll associate you with tourist and see you as a pinata filled with money.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I was a pinata filled with money.
So do I. But I mean, there's coping mechanisms, this thing you learn, things you learn in this country. Like, for example, I know, like, I just got a new phone, but I know that I should never pull it out of my pocket and use it while I'm on the metro. Because that's prime, especially when you're just about to stop at a station, because that's what I've seen it done. Like someone is just using their phone, checking a message, someone rips it out of their hand and runs. But also I know because I made a friend who was a police officer, the pickpockets look at what phone you have. So if you got like an iPhone 7, you're fine. They're probably not going to steal it from you. They're looking for the hallmarks of like phones that they could resell, phones that are worth money, you know? So they're looking at like, how many cameras does it have? Does it look like a 12? Does it look like a 13?
Yeah, I have those OtterBox cases. And people always make fun of me because they're like, it makes your phone look hideous. And I'm like, yeah, great.
But they don't know what phone I have.
It's protection.
Yeah, it's true.
So you mentioned to me another time ago that you actually moved to Paris during the pandemic.
Yes.
And it's only now that you're able to experience La France.
Like super recently. Yeah. And it was, I mean, moving, because we lived in Normandy. So I moved to France in September 2020. Actually, September 10 is when I moved, the day before 9/11. And we arrived, we lived in Normandy in my fiance's childhood bedroom with our cat, which was quite a shining moment for me at the age, I think I was 34 back then. Just like, oh, look, I've really made it. I'm living in my in-laws' house with where no one speaks English. It was tough. But like we actually had to do our move, not during lockdown, but during curfew. And that was difficult because we were going from Normandy to the Petit Couron, like, so just outside the periphery. And just trying to get everything done before 6 p.m. Because like we had my in-laws helping us move. So they had to make sure that they were going to be able to drive home before the 6 p.m. cutoff, because like, I don't know if you noticed, but like people were getting controlled at that time. People were, so France, Paris for me, probably for the first year was just my apartment. And then the occasional stand-up gig when things opened up again. But it's only, I still would probably say, I haven't really truly experienced the city yet, because work is the, that's one thing I wasn't really prepared for. I spent 5 years living in a place where everything is 10 minutes away. And I forgot what commuting is and how you can spend easily. Most people, even if they live in the center of Paris, most people travel a minimum of 40 minutes to and from work every day. Most people, like it's, you spend so much time on public transport. So when you go out places, especially when we've all been at home for so long, there's this element of, yeah, I'm going to go and I'm going to have fun. But then when I'm tired, it's going to be another hour before I can be in bed. It's going to take so long to get home. So I'm still kind of getting over that, just putting that into the back of my mind and surrendering myself to the fun. Plus, I had COVID 2 weeks ago for the first time. So that was my, like, I finally started going out of the house and I got COVID. So, yeah, but I was at the Eiffel Tower for the first time, 2 weekends ago, just to take a picture for my show. I don't know. I haven't really seen much of this city, but I'd like to.
Time is the way I see it. You always have time. I think the best time to explore any city is in the summer. And since you came in September, mid-September, probably wasn't the best time. That's when it starts to get a bit cold. And also it's the return back to school, return back to work.
Right. Last summer was like still strict policy, masks everywhere, and then they kind of lifted it in August. But we actually went on a proper summer vacation to the south of France. So I agree with you 100%. I'm actually excited. I'm excited about the first Aperol spritz of the year, because today the weather's nice.
Oh, it's so nice. I was not prepared. But yeah, no. I think Paris is incredibly fun in the summer. I'll warn you that August, it's completely empty. You might like that. You might enjoy that. You might enjoy an empty Paris.
Well, I was here last August, and I remember that it was empty. I mean, I get very conscious whenever people ask me about, like, oh, can you be honest about your experience in France? I apologize always, because it's like, I know it always sounds horrible. It always sounds like my experience here has been bad. Because it has been, but it, like, and I say that in a humorous way, it's just that I think, France was, and I did a series on TikTok about like frequently asked France questions. And one of the things is like, stuff you wish you knew before you came here. And it is a very different country. It's a very different society. It's a very different, it's probably like I'm 37 this year. I do not have a degree, and it has never been a problem my entire life. Like, I've always managed to to have stand up and also whatever side hustle and make ends meet and actually save money and all of those things from all of the skills that I have. But this is the first time in my entire life, and this is the third country I've full-time lived in. It's the first time where there's the way they do things. And if you don't do them that way, it's basically almost like no one foreign has ever moved here ever. Like that's an exaggeration, but it often feels that like, oh, so there's no recognition of anything anyone has done outside of this country ever. No. If you want a job, you need to go get a degree. If you have a degree, it better be French. If it's not French, you can go back to where you came from. But what I would say to try and put a positive spin, on that, I have learned a lot about like things that do make life better in France. And I look forward to the point where my French is good enough that I can sort of feel like I'm integrated a bit more into society. Because one thing a lot of people don't realize, you can move somewhere and not speak the language and succeed. But if you're never fluent, most of the people never know who you are. That's probably one of the biggest things. The thing that sucked for me the most when I was in Normandy is that I learned for the first time in my life, I've been doing comedy for so long. Like the first time I ever did stand up, I was 19 years old. I sucked, but you know, that was my virgin experience. But what sucked the most when I first moved to Normandy is like I was living with my partner's family. And I felt like they didn't know who I was because humor is so important to me. Making people laugh is so important to me. For the first time in my entire life, I couldn't make anyone laugh at all. Like my days were humorless. I was never making people smile and it killed me. And over time, like now I can sort of, you know, I can't make I'm no gad in French. I'm not even a blanche, but I can sort of, you know, crack a smile. And I think I look forward to me being more integrated and falling in love with this city. That's what I would say. Because even though I have a show on May 7th called I Hate Paris, I'm open to the idea. Did you not know that's what it's called?
No, I just had no idea.
It's called ahead and it's strategic. It's, you know, I mean, it's basically, I mean, the show isn't just me pissing on Paris. It's just me doing comedy, but you know, no one else is going to have a show called I Hate Paris. You see a show called I Hate Paris, you'd be like, why?
No, I think it's very relatable, to be honest. I mean, this podcast is called Emily is Not in Paris for a reason.
She's not. She ain't here. She ain't here.
Was never here.
No, she was never here. It's probably on a film set. Yeah. that stupid bitch.
that I'll cut out.
Okay.
For your career.
I do look forward to falling in. And sometimes I do find that there are, like, my bitter, cold heart has little warm moments sometimes, like my neighborhood. I really like my neighborhood. I, you know, as you said before, I won't say where it is. But I just a matter of personal opinion, I won't live somewhere where everyone is white. Like I don't trust it. Like a little bit of background as someone who Australia is quite diverse. But also like my partner's not white. He's not. He is of mixed heritage. As part of being in a, I guess you'd say, international, interracial couple, I've seen what happens when people don't have the same skin color sometimes. So it's, yeah. So I love our neighborhood because it has, there's people from like, from Armenia, Portugal, you know, Russia, Poland. There's people from like West Africa and like Cameroon. And there's like all these different cultures and families. And there's so much different food in our neighborhood. And I just, look, one of my favorite experiences of living here is just when I go to the boulangerie, when I go to get bread, because to get there, I have to walk past, there's like four laundromats, I don't know why, in the same street. And then beside each one is a cafe, and each cafe services a different section of old men in the community. So like there's the Portuguese cafe is the favorite of the Armenian men. Yeah, I know. I don't understand. But like, and then you've got like, there's the Algerian barber, and like, I just love seeing all the people like there. I wonder, their day is just, let's hang out. and they're, everyone is happy and, you know, having conversations, and it's just, yeah. I like it. I like it. It's probably the only place in Paris where I genuinely let my guard down and I feel safe. And yeah, it's my hood.
No, I see what you mean. And I think that's a testament to France, the beauty of France and the beauty of Paris or Île-de-France or, you know, surrounding suburbs, is that it's so diverse. And I think people kind of lose sight of that if they stick to places like the Champs-Élysées and the Louvre. And I mean, these are places that are interesting, you know, beautiful to see, but
I mean, let's not kid ourselves. They're like, just for anyone listening, there's still racism. There's still xenophobia. There's still like, I'm not diminishing any of that by saying that my neighborhood is a diverse, lovely place. It still exists, you know, but I agree with you. It is like, it is, The face of France is not one. It's not one face.
No, it's not one face. And it's important that people see that and understand that and embrace that culture as well, you know? But yeah, cool. Sweet. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. And anytime. I cannot. Yeah, yeah. And I cannot wait to see your show in a couple of weeks. I will definitely remember to get tickets right after this. And can you please let us know where we can find you, like your ats, all your ats and your website?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. On all my social media, usually I'm just Jono Duffy, J-O-N-O, D-U-F-F-Y, or the Jono Duffy or Jono Duffy. I think it's just those two. I'm on Instagram, I'm on TikTok, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter. I'm not great at all of them, but I'm there. I have a website, jonoduffy.com. Mainly if you want to find out what I'm doing in Paris or France, TikTok's the place.
Cool. Sweet. Well, thank you so much, Jono.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Emily Is Not in Paris, the podcast. If you like this episode, please don't hesitate to share it with friends and family. And follow us on Instagram at Emily Is Not in Paris, the podcast. And follow me at The Queen Fatima on Instagram as well.